is West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Arlene McMichael. One powerful way to help reduce racism in America is by simply having a conversation with someone different than ourselves. Race relations scholar Beverly Tatum is convinced of that.
Engagement with that other person, hearing that other person's story, seeing how their humanity is just like yours. And that is something that happens through dialogue. So when I talk about dialogue, I talk about it not as something to do just, you know, because it's nice to have substantive conversations, but because those conversations lead to relationships. Relationships lead to caring about another person. Caring about another person leads to taking action. And it's the action that is ultimately what brings about change.
Tatum was in Kalamazoo recently at the invitation of the Kalamazoo Community Foundation as part of its ongoing racial healing work. Afterwards, WMUK caught up with Tatum by phone. She's the author of the book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race? It's being re-released after 20 years. She's the former longtime president of Spelman College, an historically black women's college in Atlanta. Welcome to the program, Dr. Tatum.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be with you.
Let's talk about the formation of views regarding race. How young does this start?
Well, we know that young children notice difference really from a very early age. Even babies, researchers have noted, will pay attention to faces that are different than their own in a way that indicates that they're noticing a difference between unfamiliar faces and familiar faces. But that doesn't mean they have racial attitudes. Attitude development, of course, is something that develops over a lifetime, and young children pick up the attitudes of the adults around them. But sometimes adults are conveying attitudes without even their own adult awareness. For example, when a young child notices someone's skin color and comments on it, a parent might be responding to that simply with, shh, as in, don't talk about that, or it's rude to point, or it's, you know, don't stare. And not even assuming in that interaction that they've conveyed anything negative, but perhaps what they're conveying to that child is that there's something wrong with someone who looks different than they do. And those communications, subtle or direct, can start to shape young children's behavior in preschool. We know from observations that preschool teachers make, and parents of young children too, that their kids are commenting and asking questions. You know, why is Tommy's skin brown? Is it because he drinks chocolate milk? That was a question that my own son was given as a young African-American child in a largely white preschool. One of his white friends asked him that question, you know, or told him, in fact, your skin is brown because you drink chocolate milk. Well, of course, we know that's not true, but he didn't know that. My son came home and asked me, Mom, is this true? And of course, for the young child who was asking the question, it wasn't necessarily that he had prejudices, but he certainly had questions. And where were the adults in the environment to respond to those questions? These are the things that start to lay the groundwork for discomfort around conversations about race.
You've spoken to educators across the country. You find that the topic of slavery or any type of racial issues is a difficult topic to talk about in the classroom, especially for elementary school children, but even older children. And you have even found that African-American children say it's painful for them to sit in the classroom and hear this information. In your book, you talk about in K-12 education, there's a lot of self-segregation and other types of overt segregation that tends to go on. So it's hard to have conversations about this issue.
Sure, there's so much in your statement. One thing we know in today's society, in the year 2019, public education is very racially segregated. Many people think, oh, we solved that problem with Brown versus Board of Education back in the 50s. But in fact, our public schools had a period of desegregation in the 70s, maybe early 80s, but over the last 20 or 30 years, there's been a reversal of that trend. And so many of the places where schools had started to desegregate are now as segregated as before. And the strategies that we were using to desegregate schools, crosstown busing, for example, or magnet programs in diverse communities that hopefully would attract white students or a diverse assortment of students, many of those programs have been dismantled as a result of court rulings and other policy decisions that local communities have made. So as a consequence, because neighborhoods remain pretty much racially segregated across the nation, schools in those neighborhoods are also segregated. That means that young people don't have, unless they live in a very diverse community and those communities are relatively few and far between, most young people are going into schools where their racial group membership tends to be the majority. White kids are going to white schools largely. Black and brown kids are going to schools where black and brown children are in the majority. And that in itself creates lack of opportunity to really get to know people whose racial group is different from your own. That said, there are some other things that are part of this problem, and that has to do with education and curriculum and how teachers, most of whom in today's schools, most of our teachers are white, many of them women, and those white women typically have grown up in largely white communities, and so their own life experience is not always the same as the kids that they are teaching, and they often will say that they too struggle with how to talk about issues of race. If the teacher's uncomfortable, it's likely that the classroom is not going to have the kind of learning experience that will create the capacity to have these conversations among the young children.
You've been listening to a West Southwest interview with race relations expert and former Spelman College president, Beverly Tatum, who spoke in Kalamazoo in August. And the next great opportunity that you feel that individuals could have regarding race in their educational career is by the time they get to college. Yet there's a problem inherent in that. There was an interview you gave inside higher education in 2017, and you were talking about, because of this persistent school segregation, that even though college is a great place where they can have this conversation and different races can get to know each other, that's hard to happen if schools aren't intentional in making that happen.
Yes. So one of the things we know is that colleges and universities today are more diverse than ever before. Even a school like Harvard University has reported that now more than half of its class is made up of students of color in the incoming class, you know, freshman class. So we know that these learning environments are more diverse than they were 20 years ago, but students are still coming to them from segregated schools, which means that they don't have much practice at connecting across lines of difference. And just because you live in the same residence hall or are sitting in the same classroom with students who look different from you doesn't necessarily mean you're getting to know them. We know that all of us tend to be drawn toward the familiar. So it's easy to connect with someone who you think you have a lot in common with, who comes from a place similar to you or speaks a language similar to you. But trying to make friends across lines of difference sometimes means moments of awkwardness. How do you pronounce that person's name? What is the preferred language that, the slang that they're using? Is that the same as the slang you use? You know, all of those things can be overcome, but it requires intentionality. And one of the things that some colleges and universities are doing is creating opportunities for kids to have structured opportunity to dialogue, to talk about some of the life experiences that may not be shared across lines of difference, to talk about issues of social justice, for example, to talk about the isms, whether that's racism or anti-Semitism or heterosexism, to engage in substantive conversations about which there may be differences of opinion and certainly different life experiences, but to do that in a way that allows for true connection and hopefully empathy. And that ultimately leads to positive relations, and positive relations often leads to change in social action and policy.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a moment. There's a term that's used, a post-racial society, and Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines it as having reached a stage or time at which racial prejudice no longer exists or is no longer a major social problem. There might be some in the country who feel that, hey, slavery was a long time ago, and hey, we've had a black president. There's not a problem. What is the problem? Just get over it. You know, why do we have to be so intentional about it? Why do we have to keep talking about race?
Well, one of the things that we certainly heard a lot about right after the election of President Obama back in 2008 was that his election was a sign of, quote, having achieved a post-racial society. But I think if your listeners have been paying attention, we can all agree that that was perhaps premature. We see, for example, a rise in white nationalism. Think about Charlottesville, Virginia, and the deadly gathering that took place there of white nationalists. Think about the horrible incidents we see, unfortunately, on social media too often of black people being victimized by white observers who think they don't belong where they're supposed to be. You know, whether that's sitting in a Starbucks or moving into an apartment, having the police called on them for doing ordinary things when they're not breaking the law at all and simply trying to live their lives. Those examples, certainly, not to mention, you know, police shootings, et cetera, but, you know, living while black incidents that are so commonly documented today, let us know that there's still plenty of bias and prejudice operating in our society. And we know that even though we are 400 years after the start of slavery on what we now think of as the United States, a process that began in 1619, so now we're acknowledging 400 years later all that has taken place in that 400 years, what we know is that the legacy of white supremacy, the legacy of assuming that some people are superior than others, is still embedded in how our society functions. We might not like that. We want to change it. But I think if we're paying attention, we have to acknowledge that it is still with us, and we have to try to address it.
I'm wondering, what do you think is the most effective ways to address racism? Is having conversation one of the biggest ways, you think?
Well, one of the reasons I advocate for dialogue, and I see it as such an essential tool, is because we have changed laws. You know, we have laws that prohibit discrimination in housing, discrimination in employment, discrimination in other settings. But yet we still see the legacy of bias. And we also see what I'm going to call a process of othering people, seeing people as not like ourselves, whether that's immigrants at the border or, you know, inner city residents of a community that is seen as less worthy than a more affluent community. That understanding that some human beings seem to be less valuable than others is something that's still part of our society. And it is, I'm going to quote Dr. Martin Luther King here, when he says that, you know, the only way real change is going to come is when we empathize with those other people, when we see them as like ourselves. And empathy comes through engagement with that other person, hearing that other person's story.
Speaking of caring for people and taking action, when you were here recently in Kalamazoo, there's an effort going on in Kalamazoo regarding racial healing. It's the Truth, Racial Healing and Transformation Initiative, funded by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. Kalamazoo is one of 14 communities across the country that is part of this initiative. One of the things I remember mentioning when you spoke here is the upstander approach. Could you explain what it is and how effective you see that being in terms of addressing racial incidents?
Sure. Well, when something happens, whether it's, you know, somebody telling a racist joke at a party, or behaving badly in a work setting, or, you know, I mean, there are lots of degrees, right? You know, attacking somebody on a bus. I mean, you know, sometimes it's a small thing. Sometimes it's really a life-threatening situation. There are always people who will stand by silently, not intervene, not speak up. We might call those people bystanders. They're not the perpetrators. They're not the ones telling the joke. They're not the ones using the insulting language. They're not the ones attacking somebody. But they are passively standing by. And because they are bystanders, they are allowing that behavior. They're complicit in that way in allowing that thing to happen. The upstander is the person who speaks up. The upstander is the person who says, you know, I really find that language offensive. Please don't use it around me. It's the upstander who says, you know, I used to tell those jokes, but I don't find them funny anymore. Now I see that they reinforce stereotypes, and I really think that's harmful. The upstander is the person who goes to sit by that person who's being attacked. Maybe they don't feel like they can overpower the person who's threatening, but can at least sit and stand in solidarity with the person who's being threatened. There are lots of examples of upstander behavior. I think too often most of us might see ourselves wanting to be upstanders, but too often we're bystanders. But we really need all of us, and I include myself in this, we all need to be upstanders in order to speak up when we see injustices happening, knowing that our action not only is an act of integrity for our own beliefs, but also can inspire others to stand up as well.
You were speaking about how even yourself could speak up. And so you are a Black woman. So Black and brown people, we can stand up and also be upstanders. But what is the role of allies in helping to erase racism?
Yes. So all of us have the opportunity to be allies. You know, sometimes, so I am an African-American woman, and certainly I can think of times when, as an African-American, I felt in need of someone to stand up for me. As a woman, I might have felt that way too. You know, we all have multiple identities, but I am also a heterosexual person. And when I see someone being targeted because of their sexual orientation, someone who identifies as LGBTQ, you know, that's my opportunity to be the ally to them as a targeted group. I identify as a Christian. When I hear someone making anti-Semitic remarks, that's my opportunity to stand up as an ally to people who are targeted by anti-Semitism, Jewish people, or people who are being targeted by anti-Muslim attitudes. You know, that's my opportunity to speak up. When I'm an able-bodied person, and when I see that there are policies in place or practices that are making life harder for people who have disabilities of one kind or another, that's my opportunity to speak up as an ally. So all of us have multiple identities. Some of those identities may be places where we feel targeted, but there are other places where we are part of the dominant or majority group, and we need to recognize that when we have that position, we also have responsibility to use our majority status to stand up for those who may be marginalized.
Dr. Tatum, thank you so much for making time to talk with us. Is there any topic that you might have wanted to address that I did not ask you today?
Well, I really want to appreciate your giving some time to this topic and invite your listeners to think about how can I be an upstander, because all of us have that capacity in our spheres of influence at home, at work, and we all need to recognize that being silent on this topic will not protect any of us.
Dr. Tatum, former president of Spelman College, racial issues scholar, and the author of Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
For West Southwest, I'm Earlene McMichael.